broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Investor Exchange. I'm hosting today, Louis van Copenhagen, and joining me in the studio of UGC is Joel Hewish.
Good morning, Louis.
Good morning, Joel. And Brett Dickinson.
2 weeks in a row, Louis.
I know.
Getting good at this.
I am. I'm flying.
Yep.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Steph, a straight poster, got Steph flying all over the country. I've been batching it for the last week, which has been good.
So no, Australia Post do get things to where they belong.
They're sending
stuff.
Packages away.
they can deliver.
They can deliver. There we go.
Yeah. Which has left Joel stranded by himself at home.
Yeah.
Oh, you poor thing.
I know.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's cooking your meals?
No such thing as cooking.
Are you eating cold?
Deliveroo gets a fair workout.
Ah, yes. So Deliveroo over who's... Uber Eats?
Yeah,
I've never tried either.
Yeah, I'll tell you why. Because Uber Eats, they can't find a car park in the city, so they make me come down and pick it up off them. Whereas Deliveroo have the little scooters or the bikes, and so they actually can just leave it out the front and come up.
There you go.
Who would have thought that's the decision maker?
Yeah.
That makes sense, though.
Well, it's all part of the service. That's what makes a good company over a bad one. Yes, yes. And good to know that your life is still running smoothly, relatively, Joel. Without someone around to organise it for you.
Yes.
Shout out to Steph, probably enjoying an easier job this week.
Yeah, by comparison.
Being on the road with your job.
She doesn't seem to complain when she's going away.
All right. Well, there has been controversy in the internet lately.
Yeah.
I've been made aware of it. And in Australia, we had a big pushback. This was a few years ago. If you remember the economist and commentator Bernard Salt, said that avocado on toast was the reason why people can't afford a first home.
That's right. He was talking mainly about Gen Y.
Millennials, Gen X,
Y. Yes. Whoever it was. Yes. Saying, if they stopped eating all their smashed avo on toast,
that's
they
right.
Pay a deposit.
So this has come back now in the form through the US and some money experts who have been promoted by channels like CNBC have come out and said, if you cut back on your daily coffee, you can have $1 million in your bank by the end of it.
By when?
That's right. So, here's the thing. People are very sensitive to other people suggesting that their way of life is somehow incorrect or some having their purchasing decisions invalidated, particularly when those purchasing decisions are habitual and part of their lifestyle and something that they really enjoy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the maths is, if you have two coffees a day during the working week, and you're paying $4 a day for your coffee, it's $8 a day, 5 days a week, let's say 50 weeks a year, that's $2,000 per year that you're spending on coffee that you could theoretically put into something else.
Yep.
Now, if you do this from the age of 30 up to the age of 65, which is the standard person's retirement age, not if you're doing the right thing with your money, you should be able to retire sooner than that, but that's why you come to us for help. Anyway, if you're doing that for 35 years, well, you could have about $600,000 if you're earning a 10% return on your $2,000 per year. And $600,000 is a pretty decent chunk of extra money to have on retirement.
Yeah.
Of course, if you're earning 13%, which is the target return of UGC investors, instead of $600,000, you'd actually have more than $1.2 million. That extra 3% return doubles your retirement savings. Mm. So that's the effect of compound interest. But the flair that this has created is a whole bunch of people pushing back against saying, well, my daily coffee is my habit and I don't want to change it. It's not actually going to make a difference. We've got takeaway coffees with us right here in the studio.
Guilty.
So there is what's called an outrage cycle happening on the Twittersphere and on Instagram. So what do you think, guys? Do you think stopping drinking coffee will make you better off in retirement?
Well, let me just finish my mouth full.
Look, at the end of the day, if I didn't have my coffee, I wouldn't get anything done, so I wouldn't earn the money in the first place. I need my coffee to get up and running.
Yeah.
Look, I could see there's a principle behind the discussion that you've got to cut somewhere in order to save. If you're not a saver, you're going to have to cut something out to find money to put into investments. But what that is doesn't necessarily have to be smashed avo or coffee. It could be whatever else suits that person's lifestyle.
Yeah.
That's my opinion. I think if you're someone that loves coffee and you want it as part of your lifestyle, I think if you start sort of neglecting all of your desires, you're going to feel like it's a burden to save.
Yeah, exactly.
And you resent it.
Yeah, and that's where I'm coming from as well. And now the countering opinions from other so-called financial experts is just go ahead and buy the friggin' coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, I'm on board.
Stop it. Just stop it. Everybody telling everybody else how to live. Just stop it. God, I live in the city. I see three protests every Saturday from vegans and other people. Just stop it.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, I've been asked for my opinion on this, which is always nice because anyone who knows me knows that I like to give my opinion, even when it's not asked for. So what is my actual financial opinion on this? Well, it's not just a straightforward, if you stop spending $8 a day here, then it automatically becomes savings, which automatically earns a return, which automatically becomes retirement savings. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work straight through like that.
No, it doesn't.
All these things in our lifestyle all add up to factors. And then out of those factors and the combination of all those factors, you then need to have the savings and then put those savings into something which then ends up as a retirement plan. So if you're standing in line for a coffee right now listening to this podcast, well, go ahead and get it because right now your decision is only about $4.
Yeah.
So just buy the coffee that you're buying today. But if you are trying to consciously decide, well, should I be doing this or should I not be doing it? Well, okay, let's look at a few things. What is your energy and capacity to choose to cut back? Because, Brett, as you alluded to, you can't cut back on everything.
No. Well, we're just going to cut back on all of our meals next?
No.
Just to save?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And adding fuel to the fire is some of the so-called experts are saying, well, we've got all this discretionary spending like a gym membership. Well, hang on. That's not discretionary because you're taking care of your health.
Yeah.
And discretionary spending like buying lunch. Mm-hmm. Well, hang on. I'm not sure that's discretionary because another factor is the time that you have.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If you're spending more money to save time and improve your health, I don't see that as something that you should be cutting back on. That's part of being efficient and productive and looking after yourself.
And I agree. I'm hopeless at pre-preparing my lunch and shopping for it, whatever it needs to be. And in fact, I'd probably spend more money because I go to the supermarket to buy everything and I buy more than I need.
Yeah.
End up throwing half of it out. So I might as well just bought it directly on the day.
Agree.
Yeah,
agree.
That's right. And if you've had your coffee before you go shopping, well, maybe your brain's working better. Yeah. You can make better purchasing decisions.
Yeah.
Not throw shit away.
Mm.
Yeah?
Yeah?
Okay. Now, if it is something like coffee, then another thing is managing our emotions.
Mm.
Because
how do we do that?
For me, if I have my coffee and I need my coffee, well, then I'm going to be in a better frame of mind. Like Joel, I'm going to be more productive and get more stuff done. Like Brett, I'm going to make better decisions at the supermarket.
Thank you.
And this can all help. But the other thing is, what about the availability of alternatives?
Yeah.
Now, this workplace here has a coffee machine in the office. So work pays for my coffee.
And it does get a fair workout.
It does.
It gets
does,
a really
yeah.
good workout. And still, occasionally, I do get a hankering for a really good coffee.
Mm.
So occasionally, I'll still get out and get a good barista-made coffee instead of the Nespresso stuff here. But for the most part, I'm not spending $8 a day. But even then, it still doesn't necessarily translate into $2,000 a year put into savings.
Yeah. No.
So it comes back to having the savings habit.
Yeah.
There's no point cutting back on anything unless you've got the savings habit to put that money away into something else.
Mm-hmm. And depending on what your savings amount is, getting that 10% up to 13% is probably going to outweigh the money you would spend on coffee.
Well, that's right, Brett. Absolutely. You don't need to save $4 per coffee if you're earning an extra 3% return on your investment.
Yeah.
Well, then maybe you only need to save a lesser amount and you can have more today. Mm. So all these things factor in. For me, if you're looking to make a better decision today, then make it the path of least difficulty. Something that I really hate when I read other people's financial advice, I hate these articles that point out all these problems and then say, if you're going to solve these problems, the first thing you need to do is a budget. I hate budgets. No one likes budgets. As soon as you say the word budget, you're putting in my mind the need to sit down at a computer for hours and plan out my expenses.
Yeah.
That's not the path of doing things easily. So if you want to do things easily, just start a savings program.
Yeah.
Just go onto your internet banking, open up a separate savings account, and put $10 a week into it as an automatic transaction. And that's it. Job done.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That is 1 minute.
Mm.
That is not difficult to do, and it's not a lot of money to do. So that's my financial advice.
Yep.
And now that you've done that, go ahead and buy your coffee or your takeaway food or your gym memberships and do it without guilt. Because this feeling of being guilty about your purchases is not good for anyone.
I think we're all reasonably big sports fans, and I listen to a lot of the the crossovers between sports and business and life, and it always comes back, in my opinion, to there's some basic fundamentals that every successful business, person, sports team does. And the basic fundamental you're talking about here is just have a savings plan. If you don't have it, the basic fundamentals lacking, a lot of other things won't work anyway.
Yeah.
So it's just have that basic.
Exactly, exactly. It is that fundamental. And so many of the great coaches or investment advisors or hedge fund managers, they just have that basic principle.
Yep.
And they keep coming back to that basic principle.
It keeps coming back to it.
Which is not unique information for their field.
No, like just the discipline.
Vince Lombardi, the story about Vince Lombardi, the great American football coach, is he would start each season with his preseason training program would be, gentlemen, this is a football. And he would start with the absolute basics of football. Doesn't matter that these guys are professionals who have been playing since they were 10 years old. He would start with the basics each season.
Yep.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of secrets.
Well, and pretty much everyone these days has a computer of some sort. Microsoft are always telling you to save. You want to close a document? Save. You want to close a spreadsheet? Save. Yep. So you're being prompted to save all the time.
Oh, Brett. I love it.
Yep.
You win.
The reminders are everywhere.
Very good. Very good.
That's the best thing I've heard all day. Sure, it's only 8:30 in the morning, but it is the best thing I've heard all day.
Very good.
Thanks, Brett.
Sure, pleasure.
All right, listeners, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back after these messages.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
And welcome back. Thank you, listeners. I'm going to kick it over to Brett.
Yeah, thanks, Louis. I would like to have a discussion with you guys, actually, about REITs, and in particular, a REIT. So for people that don't understand it, the word REITs is REIT, which is Real Estate Investment Trusts, and mm-hmm. the A in front of it is for Australian. Mm-hmm. So basically, they're a way for investors to get access to property investments that they wouldn't be able to get on their own. So it has a number of benefits. And typically, they're listed on the stock exchange. So they're a publicly traded share similar to the other companies that may have been discussed in the past. Mm-hmm. Reason I wanted to bring this up is I saw a notice yesterday that the capital raising by the Australian REITs at the moment is at an all-time high. So the appetite's very high at the moment, probably mainly because typically REITs have an income component that's quite good, especially in a low interest rate environment. But to just put some perspective on this, figures from JP Morgan this week say that Australia's big listed REITs have raised $2.1 billion this year in 2019. Okay. So a large chunk of money. And they're saying that, so the major players, so one of them, Dexus, have raised nearly $1 billion. Mervac, who's a name a lot of us may have heard of, raised $750 million. But there's a lot of smaller ones too. There's the likes of Growthpoint, they're raising $150 million. GPT are a big one, they've raised $100 million. So across all of that, $2.1 billion is a lot, and there's more capital raisings, you know, coming to the market soon, apparently, too, across the whole sector.
Okay.
So I wanted to discuss when people are looking for a stock investment, because this is a stock investment at its core, isn't it? You're buying the share on the stock exchange, but the underlying asset is the property. Mm. So whilst it's property related, I don't have a really good realm of knowledge and experience about REITs. I understand the assets that they might buy and how their structure would work, but in terms of their values and whether they're something that we would assess for people to put in their portfolio, Joel, do you have an opinion, or is it something you look at with them?
It's certainly a component of our income portfolio. There's no doubt about that. Yep. We have a couple of them in there. REITs often come in a stapled structure.
Yeah.
So they tend to have an ordinary share stapled to a unit in a unit trust. And what that tends to mean is that you've got the manager that is operating the operating business, and you've got the real estate that is in the unit trust that combine together to create one share price or entity where you're sharing in the results of not just the real estate that underlines the unit,
so the growth,
but also the profits that the management company generates as well.
Mm. Yep, that's the way I understood it. So
so a lot of these GPT and Mervac and Dexus and Goodman Group, most of these have that type of structure, and you're getting essentially exposure to part development management, part property management, part the performance of the underlying real estate that the company owns, or that the unit trust owns. And it can be a very nice way to make a nice, solid, stable dividend. Usually there's a little bit of gearing that goes into these unit trusts. Back in the mid-2000s, prior to the global financial crisis, many of these were highly leveraged. In fact, in the 10 years leading up to the global financial crisis, the best performing sector on the ASX was Australian real estate investment trusts and listed property trusts. That all blew up though when the global financial crisis came about, and many of these had to raise huge amounts of equity at depressed prices during the GFC, as debts were being called in and the ability to refinance was very difficult. I think they learnt their lessons, and many of them today, while they still employ some gearing and some leverage, it's much more conservatively leveraged these days compared to where they were back in the mid-2000s leading into the GFC. So they've performed phenomenally well. And if I've just gone through and just had a quick look at the share prices of Goodman, GPT, Mervac, Charter Hall, and they're all in well-established uptrends right now.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, they're all displaying, you know, the perfect sort of ideal trend, just breaking out into new all-time highs. Prices trading above rising 10, 50, and 200-day moving averages on large. So, you know, it's probably timely to start to have a think about that. If you're in retirement phase, it's probably not a bad time to have a bit of a think about getting some exposure to those types of investments.
In that snapshot you got there, Joel, was Stockland one of the ones you've got information on? Because I've got something here that I thought, wow, that's impressive. Obviously, it's
funny. Stockland is actually the only one bucking the trend up until recently. So Stockland has was in a well-entrenched downtrend for about the last 2 years. In fact, since mid-2016. But in the last 2 months or so, Stockland has gone on a bit of a tear. Mm. And now looks to be reversing that trend.
Yeah, because that was the one in some of the other data I was looking at. It's this stood out to me. It said Stockland is up over 27% year to date, and it's offering a yield of around 6.3%.
Wow, nice.
So, which I mean, sounds really attractive, but obviously that's only short term. So there needs to be more assessment than that. Yep.
There's another consideration with investing in these REITs is that they also have a component of deferred income. Now, does anyone know what deferred income actually is?
Please explain.
Look, if you're going to be investing in real estate, residential real estate or commercial real estate, you'll typically get a depreciation allowance. And that depreciation allowance will reduce the amount of tax that you're able to, that you have to pay. So it's a deduction, it's a non-cash deduction that you're afforded because of the allowance that the tax rules provide for recognising the decline in value of fixtures and fittings and building components. With these listed property trusts, because they're held within unit trusts, they can't give that direct depreciation passed on to the investors. So what tends to happen is that there's a component of the distribution that will be recognised as deferred income, which essentially is a depreciation allowance passed on to unit holders, which means that a certain proportion of the income that is received is not taxable as well.
Okay. Mm. Okay. So I guess by comparison, it's a bit like a franking credit on a company.
Little bit, yeah, a little bit.
It's just a little bit tax effective in the income that you receive.
It does work the same way as depreciation, though. So what I mean by that is that if you buy a unit in one of these stapled units, companies, A-REITs, and you pay, let's say, a dollar, and you're claiming that deferred income through the life of your ownership, then it does reduce the cost basis of that unit as well.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I see. All right.
The last part of it that I thought was worth highlighting. Just one other bit of data that I thought was interesting. So as you alluded to, Joel, they seems to be mainly for a fixed interest component of the investors. Obviously, there's a growth component, but the majority of investors seem to be looking at it for a fixed interest. And apparently over the distribution yield has a consistent margin above the 10-year bond rate. So if people are looking at fixed interest, it seems to be the better performing of some of the fixed interest options out there. The other thing, with all this capital raising going on and a lot of those REITs that you said they're, you know, in an uptrend, I would assume that there's going to be some significant transactions of assets around the country as well. So a lot of commercial buildings now. The reason REITs become a really attractive option and the reason they probably exist is because if you wanted to buy a shopping centre or a big office block in the CBD, well, it's really hard for an individual or a group of friends or people together to buy that.
That's right.
You're talking hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah. Correct. Go to your bank manager and ask for that.
Can I just borrow $99 million?
Yeah, $150 million, please.
Yeah. So they're buying assets that, you know, individuals and, you know, smaller entities just can't get access to. But if they're raising this amount of capital and their share prices are growing, I would imagine there's going to be quite a few significant transactions around.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah. I think if you're going to get into a real estate investment trust, well, then your investment decision is a bit different to looking at a share. When you're looking at a share in a company, because companies sell goods and services, and you can look at their sales and are the revenues growing and what's the underlying financials. When you're looking at a real estate investment trust, your look at the underlying assets is very much more similar to buying an investment property. You're looking at, well, what's the value of the asset today? And in the real estate investment trust, you want to look at, well, what properties does it actually own? And you'll find, well, it owns an office block in Melbourne, another two in Sydney, it owns a shopping centre in Brisbane. So you need to look at all these underlying assets because that's what you're investing in.
Yep.
You're actually a unit holder that owns the land and the building. And therefore, your considerations are very similar to buying an investment property in your own name. Yeah. So, what is the asset that I hold? What's the physical building? What is the likely future growth of that building? What is the rent that it receives? And what rental manager do I have in place to look after it? Mm. Now, your ability as a unit holder to change the rental manager is not really there. Mm. So you want to make sure that the rental manager that is there has a track record of delivering on collecting those rents, tenanting out their buildings in full, and keeping that rent income coming in.
There, and just bear in mind also that there is a growth component to these as well, because many of these listed property trusts and, well, they used to be listed property trusts, Australian REITs, also have a development component to them. So a number of them do have greenfield sites where they're developing new shopping centres and commercial real estate spaces, industrial parklands, these types of things. And you also do have some tie-in as well to the economic fortunes of the particular tenants that you have. So many of them, like Westfield shopping centres and other shopping centre complexes, also take a small charge of the turnover of the retail outlets within those shopping centres as well. So it's important to note that it's not quite as... it's not quite as
clear cut
and exactly like an investment property, because there are some cyclicality to those types of operations as well.
What I don't think you're going to get from a real estate investment trust is the same kind of return you can potentially get from investing in companies, because if you've got a company that's providing a service or a product, that company could really hit a good vein and their sales could double or triple or go 10 times. You know, they could be an Amazon that starts from almost nothing and becomes huge. Whereas with the real estate investment trust, they're still buying a land and a physical building, which, you know, could double in value over time.
But the market will always be valuing it and it'll be more accurate.
Correct, yeah.
There won't be as much speculation either.
That's right. So you're never going to get your kind of 10 times growth in a real estate investment trust. So
they won't trade at 80 times future revenue.
No.
Future revenue.
That's right. No.
Look, we exactly right, Louis. We have real estate investment trusts within our income portfolios. We don't have them in our growth portfolios.
So even though you do buy it on the stock market, treat it as a different asset class. Yeah. It is in the property asset class.
Yeah.
It's not in the shares asset class. And it's also not in the fixed income asset class. And Brett, you said that the yields on REITs is more attractive than the yields on bonds.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But they're different asset classes. And bonds, the advantage of bonds is that they are very much more stable in their capital value. And if we go to the extreme example of the global financial crisis, before the global financial crisis, a typical financial advice piece would have been, well, you're going to retirement, let's maximize your yield. So let's go into real estate investment trusts because they provide more yield than bonds. Global financial crisis happens, property prices halve, the value of those investments in REITs halves, whereas your bonds, well, they hold on to their value because it's a different asset class. Bonds don't have that ability to fall in price like real estate can. So again, you got to have your asset allocation right between shares, property, bonds.
Yeah, and just to put an emphasis on that point, these are riskier than fixed income. Just looking at a chart of GPT. So GPT at the peak in 2007 was valued at $19 a share or a stapled unit. It fell all the way down to a dollar during the global financial crisis.
Wow.
And today is only trading at $6.50.
Cool.
If I did the same thing for Mirvac, Mirvac was trading at $5.50. It fell all the way down to... about 66 cents. Today, it is trading at around about $3.17, depending on what day you're looking at it. So you got to understand that this is not just a pure play on underlying real estate values, there is an active component to it, and there is a debt component to it, and you've also you got to be comfortable that management are running these things prudently, because if they over leverage, or if they make mistakes, or they end up with impaired assets that can't be sold, it can have a significant impact on the value of the units that you're invested in. Having said that, many of them have learnt their lessons from what happened during the GFC, and are significantly less geared today than where they were going into the GFC.
I think that's a big reflection of it, is the underlying borrowing levels, that gearing ratio. Of course, the returns when you're geared, the returns are going to be much better when you have higher borrowing levels, until something goes wrong, and that's what happened in the GFC. And the value of companies before the GFC is at higher gearing levels with longer term forecast returns, whereas today those forecast returns are lower. So yeah, they've gone through a deleveraging from where they were 10 years ago to where they are today. So there you go.
Very good.
All right.
That was the type of discussion I wanted.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well, there you go on real estate investment trusts. Contact us if you have any other questions or want to look at putting a portfolio together. We'll head over to a quick break and we'll be back.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Hello again. All right. Who's next?
Can't be me.
Must be me. Yeah.
Must be.
All right, well, guys, look, I wanted to talk about, and just continuing on that theme last week of these crazy valuations that we're seeing in some of these stocks, for those listeners that weren't with us last week. We spoke about Zoom Video Communications and Beyond Meat that were trading at around 80 times historical sales. What that means is you would have to wait 80 years for the level of sales that the company is generating to equal the investment that you've made in that stock. Then that's sales. That's not profit.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and I just made the point that this was getting a little bit ridiculous in some parts of the market. Today, what I want to talk about is a strategy that we'll be rolling out with our hedge fund later this year, which is what we call short selling. And I spoke briefly about the fact that Beyond Meat and Zoom Communications were potentially ideal short-selling candidates. Now, for those people who don't know what a short sale is, it's essentially betting against the performance of a stock.
Okay. You don't like the word betting at the moment?
No, not betting. No betting, that's true. Yes, yes, Jaden Stevenson, yeah. You nut. But anyway.
well, the way I explain it is when you're buying investments, you want to buy low and sell high.
Yeah.
So when you're short selling, you want to sell high and buy low. It's the same thing.
Correct.
You're just doing the selling before you're doing the buying.
That's right. Now, we won't get too deep into the mechanics of how a short sale works, but other to know that you're essentially reversing that process. That's right. So you can actually sell stock that you don't own by borrowing stock from somebody else, wait for the share price to then fall, and then you buy that share back, give the share back to the person that you borrowed the stock from, and you're profiting from the fall in the value of that share. Mm-hmm. So you might sell at $100, the share price falls down to $25, you go and buy the shares back because you have to give that stock back to the person who you borrowed the stock from. It costs you $25 to buy it back, but you've pocketed the $75 difference.
Do you have to pay anything for the borrowing amount?
There is some borrowing. Yep. Yeah. There is some borrowing costs. Yeah, borrowing costs. Yep. And that you would pay to the person who you've borrowed the stock from. Mm-hmm. All right. So just to go into how you might play those crazy situations and how you might profit from it. Well, our approach to buying stocks when they're in when we're looking to invest in it is that we were looking for great quality businesses that are cheap, that we can buy at a fair price, and that are in the early stages of a new uptrend. Well, guess what we do when we're looking to bet against stocks that we think are going to fall in value?
It should be the opposite.
It's not exactly a great company.
A very horrible business that is expensive and in the early stages of a downtrend. Okay. Mm-hmm. But there are some catalysts that we need to identify. Now, shorting is a very hard thing to do consistently, okay, and do it consistently well and make profits out of, because the reality is that even bad stocks go up in value when you're in a bull market, and about 75% of stocks in a bull market will rise in value.
Mm.
So to be able to find that 25% that are bucking the trend, and to find that 25% that are bucking the trend in a way that is meaningful enough to add value or alpha, outperformance, to your portfolio can be very, very difficult. So it's something that you do in highly selective situations. It's not something that you go and just say, oh, look, you know what, I see this stock, I reckon it's a little bit overvalued, I'm going to enter into this short. No, you need to see something that is material, that could be a significant catalyst for an immediate decline or a short-term decline in that stock. Mm. The other thing about shorting is that theoretically, your risk is unlimited, because a share price can go as high as what you can imagine.
Oh, yeah, true.
Where the maximum upside is only 100% on the short side. Doesn't matter what price you pay for it. It could be $1,000 falling down to zero, or $100 falling down to zero, or a dollar falling down to zero. Your maximum you can make on that position is only 100%.
Yeah.
So it's important that when you're assessing that particular business, that while it must meet that criteria of being a really crappy business that is expensive and in the early stages of a downtrend, the sorts of catalysts that we look for that might be recognizable in the immediate term, say in the next 6 to 18 months, there's a number of them here that I'd like to list off. So we like instances of obsolescence, technology obsolescence. Yeah. Okay, so think of Blockbuster and Netflix. Exactly. Right. I think there's only one Blockbuster store left at the moment,
and that's
in Portland, I think it is.
Wow.
Yeah, all the others have been shut down.
And what, I think, are they selling just popcorn?
Probably.
And I think at their peak, Blockbuster was a $2 or $3 billion company.
It was a huge business.
Was massive.
Huge business. And there's a funny story about Blockbuster. They actually hired an external consultant to come in. They saw Netflix. At the time, Netflix was just doing the rentals by mail. They weren't actually streaming and providing a streaming service, but they saw that as a competition. Now, the way that Blockbuster made its money was actually through late fees.
Uh-huh.
Okay, renting out the videos was a very small proportion of their revenue. The real cream on the top was the late fees, and what they realized, this consultant realized, was that their customers hated late fees. And what he actually recommended to them was to actually take over Netflix.
Oh, wow.
And they were so pissed off about the recommendation, and they were so offended about the recommendation to buy Netflix, because they thought that they were in this major ivory tower, that he felt so ashamed that they didn't like the advice that he gave him. He actually refunded the fee that he charged for that consulting advice.
Oh, really? Wow.
Within about 7 years, Blockbuster was out of business.
Oh, wow.
Jeez. I heard the founder of one of the two founders of Netflix, Mark Randolph, I heard him speak, and he described the meeting he had with Blockbuster in their office, where Blockbuster was considering buying them.
Yeah.
And so Blockbuster said, well, how much do you want to buy Netflix? And Mark Randolph, well, Netflix was in quite a lot of financial trouble at the time.
Yeah, they were prepared to sell themselves.
They were accumulating big debts.
Yeah, they were prepared to sell themselves.
And he nominated a price that he knew was enough to cover their debt at the time and save the company from going bankrupt almost.
Mm.
So he said to Blockbuster, look, our sale price is $50 million.
Yeah, incredible.
And Blockbuster said, No.
No, thanks.
See you later.
Oh, wow.
And so Mark Randolph walked out of their office and said to his mates, he said, "Oh, well, I guess we'll just have to put them out of business." And he said it as a, you know, an off-the-cuff remark at the depths of the worst of Netflix, just about going out of business.
Yeah.
And they did exactly that. They put Blockbuster out.
Fantastic story.
So the first catalyst that we look for is technology obsolescence. Okay. Mm. But the next one is obviously fraud. Now, fraud's a lot harder to identify, particularly if you're not with the financial acumen and the accounting powerhouses and all the resources to do all of the back checks and channel checks and all of the financial discovery that needs to go on to identify fraud. But if you're an individual investor, you don't need to have that. You can leverage off the resources of activist short sellers. Okay, so what's an activist short seller? An activist short seller is actually somebody who takes a position in a stock, produces all of their research that their company has put behind it, and publishes it and distributes it across a whole wide range of internet and media companies.
Case study, well, a case in point.
So a couple of these become quite prominent in the last couple of years. Mm. So Glaucus was the one that produced an activist short-selling campaign against Blue Sky.
That's the one.
Now, Glaucus produced that report and basically said that the share price, I think at the time, was trading for around about $14 on Blue Sky. And they said it was worth about $2. Well, in the end, the shares actually went to zero. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, Blue Sky has gone out of business. Now, you could have shorted that all the way down. Mm. And even though Glaucus got in at $14 and the share price fell to zero, at any point in that decline, you could have still shorted it and made the same amount of money as what Glaucus did.
Wow. Oh, that's true. Because it doesn't matter how much you put, at what point you put into it, correct, whatever you put in, whether it's at $14 or $7 on the way down, you put in your money and you earn 100% when it goes to zero.
Correct. So there's actually a great tussle going on right at the moment. There's a very famous activist short seller, Gabriel Greco, from Quintessential Capital. And he is short Aphria, which is a Toronto and New York listed, NASDAQ listed cannabis stock or pot stock. If you just get onto YouTube and you Google search Gabriel Greco Aphria, and the ticker symbol is APHA, he outlines in a very detailed 45-minute presentation at the Case Learning Conference why he is short. And honestly, it's just bewildering that this stock is even still available today to survive.
With all of that evidence in the public domain, they're still trading.
So obviously Aphria are going back and forth of fighting and rebutting some of these rebutting some of these claims. But it's pretty hard to argue against Greco's position when you see the evidence that he outlines. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be a financial whiz to bet against some of these stocks. You just need to know who to follow. So Quintessential Capital is a very famous activist short seller. You'll also get Pershing Square, which is from another very famous short seller.
So when you say these two groups, they're doing this sort of thing regularly,
Right. And they often get on CNBC. They'll often spread it out on Australian Financial Review and the like. VGI Partners also did an activist short-selling campaign that they promoted all the way through Australian Financial Review on Corporate Travel Management, which is an Australian listed company. And how you short these companies is you can simply open up a trading account with a broker that allows short selling, and they'll lend you the stock. Interactive Brokers is one of those brokers that will lend you stock to be able to sell if you don't already own it. Or you can open up CFD positions, although that comes with a lot more risk. You can buy put options as well. The next catalyst, and I'll just run through these because we've only got a short space of time, but financial distress, classic example there is Tesla at the moment. So companies that are in huge amounts of debt that have got big refinancings that are due and they're struggling to be able to turn a profit. Booms that go to bust, and we spoke about cannabis stocks late last year. We also spoke about cryptocurrency earlier in the year. Changes in consumer trends. Okay, so we saw what happened with Kraft Heinz only a few months ago. Warren Buffett made a big investment in Kraft Heinz and missed the fact that the younger generation are no longer buying packaged foods and are preferring to eat more healthy and fresh. Have their smashed avocados. unsustainable illegal business practices. There's another Whitney Tilson did a great piece on this. And once again, if you know the right people to follow, you can piggyback off their research and you can obviously use that as do your own research on top of that, but it can give you some great ideas as to where to start to look. So he did a piece on lumber liquidators, where he found that the company was producing hardwood floors. They were producing them and selling them at margins that were significantly cheaper than the rest of the competition. He started to do some inquiry. Why is Lumber Liquidators so much cheaper and producing higher margins than their competitors? Turns out that they were producing illegal products using unsafe levels of formaldehyde in their product. He exposed that on 60 Minutes. Now, at any one point in time, Lumber Liquidators ended up going to zero. At any point in time during that whole short-selling campaign, you could have put your position on.
Made 100%.
Wow.
A wave of new competition and no moat to defend against it, which brings me back to Beyond Meat. Beyond Meat is trading at a ridiculously priced share price. It is now seeing a huge wave of new competition. That competition is more cashed up, well-established, better distribution networks. I think there's just a world of pain coming for Beyond Meat,
at least
in the short term. They may survive and may prosper in the longer term, but I think there's a big hiccup coming along for them. Cyclical industries that have over-earned during the booms. Okay, so think about, remember when Hurricane Sandy went through New York? So we would typically consider cyclical industries being generally building products, commodities-based companies. Now, when you get a big natural disaster that comes through, obviously there's this big spike in demand for materials to rebuild. So a lot of basic materials companies and building companies on the east coast of America saw profits go through the roof after Hurricane Sandy, and their share prices boomed as a result of that.
But once they've delivered everything to that market, there's nothing more.
That's right. And all of that demand was only short-term and unsustainable. So they often present great shorting opportunities as well. So there are a couple of the key catalysts that we're looking for within our particular strategy. But once again, we wouldn't be looking to short any of these businesses unless they were already a very average business, or very mediocre business in financial distress or some form of challenges that they're already facing, and they were hugely expensive. We want to know that there's a lot of downside to these particular positions, and it's a great way to lower and dampen the volatility in your portfolio, so that if you've got say 75% of your portfolio in long positions and 25% in short positions, theoretically the volatility of your portfolio should be half than what the normal market would be as a result of that. So,
okay, because when the market goes up, then the positions that you've bought will go up in value.
Correct.
But when the market goes down, those positions that you've short sold will rise in value, and they'll insulate against the ones you bought, which are falling in value. Correct. So there's that insulation or buffering effect.
And if you're doing it well, then the long positions should outperform on the way up. Mm-hmm. And the short positions should outperform on the way down. And the long positions that you're invested in on the way down shouldn't fall by as much. Whereas the short positions that you're in on the way up when the market shouldn't go up by as much as what the market does. So it's a great way to dampen volatility.
Yeah. Joel, I want to make a distinction between a great product and a great company.
Yeah.
Because you can't argue that electric cars and batteries are not the way of the future.
Correct. And even Beyond Meat's products. I think there's going to be a huge demand for that product, you know?
Yep.
And Teslas are a great car, from what I can see.
Yeah, yep. Absolutely.
Great car. Yep. They can make it well. The end consumers are happy. In fact, fair to say, Tesla's...
Raving fans.
Tesla has a bunch of raving fans, and Elon Musk can't put a foot wrong for a big segment of his followers. So a great marketing message, but it doesn't mean it's a great company, because their challenges have been in actually producing those cars on time and with a profit margin.
Yeah. Correct.
So there's other challenges to that business. Still a great product. You can still love the product, but it could be not a great company financially speaking. Correct. So there needs to be that distinction. I mean, Kraft Heinz, who doesn't actually eat peanut butter and jam and maybe some Vegemite from time to time?
Yep.
I'm
great products.
Yep.
But as far as a business goes, it might not have the financials that stack up. Mm. So so I just want to make that distinction.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, okay. So just to summarize, Joel, you need a crappy company that is overvalued, that is already starting to fall in its share price.
Correct.
But even then, the share price might not fall very far.
Correct.
Or it might actually increase, turn around and increase.
You need a catalyst.
So you need this extra catalyst, which might be an obsolete product, fraudulent activity, financial distress like too much debt, a booming product which turns into a bust, changing consumer trends, unsustainable business practice, or new competition coming into the market and there's no protection around the product, or cyclical industries going up and then turning around.
And this gives me an opportunity to stick the boot in a very, very comparable manner here, because I'm going short on the Richmond Tigers, and the catalyst was the injuries.
Well, there you go.
Yep. I would have scaled into that.
They're on the downward trend. They've had a couple of injuries. That's the catalyst.
Right.
Crappy club, crappy team.
Awesome.
But going long on the pies.
Oh, very good. All right. Thanks, guys. Great topics. I think it was a wonderful learning podcast today.
Yeah,
I think our listeners should come away with some really good points from that. Let's find some more points for our listeners to take away.
Oh, with this?
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious. Let's do it. What other learning experiences can we take?
Well, I'll kick it off, Brett, if you don't mind. I'm sort of hunting around and trying to find these great corporate fails, and I've come across a number of marketing fails where companies have just completely missed the boat, or really missed what they were trying to deliver as a message. So I have this this first advertisement was from Horizons Health and Fitness Club, and a big banner that says out the front, free joining fee. Hang on. Is it free or is there a fee?
Yeah.
I've got this other one on a train platform, opposite the train platform. So you've got the rail line that goes in between the platform and the other side of the rails.
Yep.
And it's a big white poster that says, come a little closer. And then right down the bottom, it is Bergman and Sabe Funeral Services.
Oh, no.
Now, I haven't heard of this company, but apparently there's a company called Sheets, S-H-E-E-T-S, Energy Stripes. So, strips. So, I'm assuming they're either like a chewing gum or some sort of consumable strip that you take that gives you all this energy. So, they have a billboard that is posted with a female who's just come out of the swimming pool that says, I take a sheet in the pool.
Oh.
What? marketers, there's a in the Daily Mirror over in the UK, I'm guessing that would be, there is an article that has a photo of a woman grabbing her hair, you know, bent over in a chair like she's down and depressed, and it says 1 in 4 women will be beaten by their husbands.
Oh gosh.
With an advertisement below it saying, treat him to Father's Day, and advertising a Sylvester Stallone supplement product.
Oh, that is insane.
And the final one.
Wait.
There is one more. This is a bit of a racial fail. There is an advertisement of a four groups of children, or four children, all of different colours and different nationalities, and it quite clearly says, everybody deserves to be treated equally. It doesn't matter if you are black or yellow or brown or normal.
What?
Be
what's normal these days?
Mind-blowing. Jeez.
Tough to top any of those.
Oh, wow.
Goodness.
Good work.
Right.
Good work.
Jeez. That missed some proofreads.
I reckon.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Well, I'm just going to come out with a new trend. So are we all familiar with the term booty call? We won't go into detail about what that is, but there's a new one now. It's called the Foodie Call.
Really?
And it's on the back of a study done that showed that 33%, so one in three women, have admitted that they will go on a date just to score a free feed. So, guys, you know, if you've been on a date and you think you struck out, she may not have even been there for that reason.
Right.
Well,
I would have probably fallen into that 33% as well. If someone was going to take me on a date and buy my meal, I probably would have taken them up on the offer.
Free smashed Avo. put the fee into savings.
Right. It's a great way to save for your home deposit. Go on some dates for some free food.
Get it free.
Wow, amazing. Thanks, guys. Another wonderful episode. Listeners, we'll be back next week.
We will. Very good. Happy end of financial year.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, thank goodness.
Oh, and just a short message to our clients. We won't be here at 3 o'clock, after 3 o'clock.
What's done is done.
What's done is done. We're down at the pub.
Yeah.
Enjoy. Yeah, or it might be 10 a.m. for me. Yeah. I might just quit it and go.
All the best.
Very good. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.